as we speak, but I'll pause for a minute there. Nate just started the recording and we'll kind of treat this as a beginning. So
I just got the consent bubble pop up, by the way.
Oh, interesting.
It didn't pop up until the recording started.
So he must have had it on when I logged in and then re-enabled it. So for all of our guests today, let me introduce myself and this session. I am Nathan Ensminger. I'm a faculty member in the Department of Informatics in the Luddy School of Informatics, Computing, and Engineering at Indiana University. And I'm one of the hosts of a series of public events that address the intersection of ethics, values, and technology. And this project is sponsored by a generous grant from the Lilly Endowment Incorporated, who is very much concerned with providing students, educators, and citizens the tools to think about the rapid and I think sometimes overwhelming changes that are happening in the digital world that seem to affect almost every aspect of how we live and work. Today is the very first seminar in a series of planned events that will stretch through the fall semester. This particular sub-series is focused on developments in artificial intelligence. And among other topics, we will explore such issues as algorithmic bias, the role of AI bots in contemporary political discourse, the problem of fake news and myths and disinformation, and the impact of artificial intelligence and robotics on the future of work, as well as, to a lesser degree, the use of intelligent systems in medicine, education, and predictive policing. And other sub-series within this larger project will explore the ethical issues related to digital technology as they affect the life and biomedical sciences, social media, business ethics, cybersecurity, and very broadly defined, the arts and humanities. In this particular session today, the focus will be on autonomous vehicles. Of all the potential uses of artificial intelligence, perhaps none seems to the average person so likely, so imminent, possibly inevitable, and potentially transformative as the replacement of human drivers with self-driving cars. If you pick up almost any news media from whatever perspective you might imagine, there are claims about a very near future in which there will be driverless cars. And many of the vocal advocates for artificial intelligence more generally cite their first experience with an autonomous vehicle as a key moment in their emerging faith in an inevitably AI-driven future. There's almost a kind of conversion moment on the road outside of Mountain View, California, where they suddenly see the light and realize these things are inevitable. And this trope repeats itself throughout the literature. And of course, the apparently explosive growth in the capability of these vehicles over just the past decade, they seem like they have come out of nowhere, whether that's entirely true or not, suggests to many people that we are on the brink of exponential growth within the capabilities of artificial systems. And the rise of autonomous vehicles has prompted some debate about the ethical implications of these machines. Much of this is positive. Autonomous vehicles might benefit society by making transportation safer or more accessible, more efficient, less environmentally destructive. It might help us redesign our crowded urban centers, reduce our commuting time, allow us to do new and interesting things in terms of our spatial relationships. When people talk about the negative implications of autonomous vehicles, it's often framed in terms of what's called the trolley problem. And I'm going to be posting in the chat, for those of you who aren't familiar with the trolley problem, a couple useful resources for you. I encourage you to look at them after the session. But the basic premise of the trolley problem, which is a thought experiment that predates autonomous vehicles, is that a driver, whether human or robotic, is faced with an unavoidable dilemma and has to make a split-second decision. An accident is about to occur, and the driver must decide between swerving one way and striking a child, or swerving the other, which might result in the death of an elderly pedestrian. And in the case of the human driver, this allows you to engage with a set of questions about how you might make that decision. And the trolley problem is often used in that context to explore ethical frameworks. In the case of autonomous vehicles, the questions involved become even more complicated. Should a machine have been driving the vehicle in the first place? How can it make such a decision? Who is responsible for the decision that the machine makes? And is it appropriate for machines to have in their hands decisions about human life? Now, we're not going to talk about the trolley problem much today. In fact, I've asked our speakers pretty explicitly to move beyond the trolley problem. It's an interesting philosophical problem, but it actually doesn't, I think, tell us too much about how autonomous vehicles really work in both the technical sense and also the larger social sense. And so I've asked our speakers today to be deliberately contrarian, to move beyond the familiar and I think sometimes unproductive or circular conversation about the trolley problem into new intellectual territory. And so I'm going to have our two speakers spend 10 minutes or so introducing a different perspective on new kinds of ethical questions posed by autonomous vehicles. And the goal is to open up the conversation to new perspectives and new voices. And after our speakers are done with their introductions, I'm going to open up the conversation here to your voices, your perspectives, and your questions. So about half the time during this hour, our presenters will talk, and then the other remaining time will be an open Q&A. We are still learning how to use Zoom effectively in this kind of intimate workshop. Please bear with us. When you joined the session, you no doubt received a note about the fact that we are recording this session. My understanding is only the panelists will be recorded. Your names, your presence, your faces will not be recorded. But this talk is going to become part of a larger series of resources that we hope to make permanently available to the many people who are interested in ethics and technology. So the first of our presenters is Jack Stilgo, who's a senior lecturer in the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. He is also the principal investigator of a very large project called Driverless Futures, which is a three-year project looking at governance issues in self-driving cars. And he has a recent book out, very recent, hot off the presses, I think is apt here, with Palgrove, called Who's Driving Innovation, New Technologies, and the Collaborative State. Our second presenter is Jameson Wetmore, who's an associate professor in the School for the Future of Innovation and Society at Arizona State. He's also the co-director there of the Center for Engagement and Training in Science and Society. Jamie has written quite extensively about a wide range of topics at the intersection of science, technology, and ethics, including vehicle safety, food safety, and some other related issues. I've been reading Jameson's work for many, many years now. With that brief introduction to the series, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Stilgo to continue our conversation. I'm going to mute myself. His voice and screen should take over. Please, I know it's awkward in Zoom, but please join me in welcoming virtually, at least, Dr. Stilgo.
Thanks so much, Nathan, and thank you all for joining. It's great to be able to talk about these things and to talk transatlantically. these are the advantages of our current predicament, is that transatlantic conversations suddenly become a bit easier. So I'm based in London, where, as Nathan said, I work at University College London, and one of the things that I do is run a project called Driverless Futures. I'm just going to show some pictures to illustrate what that project is about and what I think some of the big questions are. Because so Nathan very wisely talked about how we're not going to talk about the trolley problem, right? Talking about how we're not going to talk about the trolley problem has become something that I do quite a lot of now, because the particular way in which issues around artificial intelligence get discussed in democratic debate and in universities as well, you know, they tend to be framed in terms of ethics, and the trolley problem is a classic case study in practical ethics, a thought experiment, as Nathan said. I believe that the actual questions to do with artificial intelligence, the questions that we should be asking ourselves in democratic societies and finding ways to govern in the face of, are questions of politics. They're not questions of ethics. They're questions like, who benefits from new technologies? Who pays for new technologies and who decides, right? These are old perennial questions of politics given new form by new technologies. Incidentally, if you haven't seen this episode of The Good Place, do see the episode of The Good Place. It will tell you more than Philosophy 101 about what the trolley problem is all about. Now, I think Jamie's going to say more about this, because Jamie is local to this case, so it seems perverse for somebody in London to talk about this. But let me just mention it as something that I've written about. When it comes to self-driving cars as a case study, you know, it's impossible to avoid the mishaps that the technology has already had in a very public way. Now, people like me, we are interested in technological failure, not for sort of morbid reasons, but because in seeing technologies fail, it reveals something about the role of technologies in society that's often kept hidden from us when technologies are doing what their designers intend to do. Jamie, I will leave to talk about this. Maybe we can bring it up more in the discussion. Suffice it to say that one of the most interesting things about this case, in which a self-driving Uber killed a homeless woman, Elaine Hertzberg, on the streets of Tempe, Arizona, was that implicated in the crash was not just the artificial intelligence, it was also the world around the car. Right, and this is one thing that I think, if we're going to make good decisions about artificial intelligence and self-driving cars in particular, we need to take seriously is the fact that technologies do not just plug and play into the world as they are. New technologies, if they are to succeed in their own terms, if they are to have wider social benefits, we need to think about what else is required. So what else is required for a self-driving car to do what it promises to do? One of the things that is required is a friendly infrastructure. Now here is an infrastructure that is designed to be friendly to cars, designed to be unfriendly to pedestrians. And I think it is in the infrastructures and roads on which self-driving cars may one day operate in particular places where the politics of self-driving cars might be decided. I'm going to show you this. So, right, YouTube is now full of these things, little demos done by small startups with nascent self-driving cars. So this is a couple of years ago. It's in Britain, so it's rubbish compared to, you know, your standard American self-driving car thing. But the thing I'd like you to just look at here is what the pedestrians are doing. This is supposed to show robotic perfection in action as this little machine trundles along. What it actually shows to my eyes is a lot of pedestrians getting out of the way of a robot. Now, this is not at all the story of the autonomous vehicle, as is told by the developers of that technology. It's a more complicated one. It's one in which ordinary humans have learned to interact with a new technology in a particular way. And this is one of those areas that I'm really interested in. So history is a really useful guide here. We can look back to the time before the motor car became the dominant mode of transport, particularly in American cities, particularly in cities of the American West, right? So this is, depending on your view, this is either, you know, low speed traffic chaos, or this is shared space in action. Multiple modes of transport in pre-earthquake San Francisco. And what happened after this is what I'm interested in, which is that after this, through a combination of innovation, policy decision, changing social norms, streets were largely given over to cars. And the ways in which streets were given over to cars are worth us paying some attention to. When the car arrived, it came accompanied by the same sort of hype, the same sort of enthusiasm for its benefits, not just for mobility, but also for efficiency and for safety, that we now see echoed with the arrival of self-driving cars. So this was from a trade publication hyping up the motor car and saying, this is going to be great, this is going to change your world. The response of many people, of many policymakers in American cities, was to say, okay, and if we're going to realize those benefits, we are going to need to tidy up the streets, which means getting pedestrians out of the way. And so we see the invention of jaywalking. If you want the history on this, I would recommend Peter Norton's wonderful book, Fighting Traffic, about the early politics of interactions between motor cars and pedestrians. So one question when it comes to the arrival of the self-driving car is, what might that do to the rules of the road? How might it change? One way in which we can imagine the politics of the self-driving car is on-road interactions. So in Britain, we have this document, the Highway Code, which tells us as drivers what is expected of us, but also it has mutual obligations on other road users. What should you expect of car drivers? What should you as a pedestrian do to behave yourself? And interestingly, it is not written in black letter law, right? A lot of this is about what good manners look like. When it was introduced in the 1930s, originally, it was introduced as a code of good manners. This is like table manners. It's like how to behave informally in social settings, the road being one of those settings. Now, self-driving cars don't deal well with manners. They need rules. So the question is, what good manners get encoded into rules and what get left out? Now, the dominant way in which currently good manners get made into law is actually through infrastructure. So we have various ways in which there are architectures of enforcement on our roads. So we see zebra crossings, we have traffic lights, known in some places still, which I love, as traffic robots, because they appear to replace the job of a traffic cop. And we have down at the bottom right there an experiment in shared space that actually is an interesting reversal of some of these things, the attempt to remove some of these things, to turn rules back into norms, to introduce some uncertainty into the situation. A situation, we might add, which would be extremely hard for a self-driving car to navigate. So the ways in which algorithms are programmed, I would say, would have important legislative type effects, following Larry Lessig, on our lives. And it will, if you follow the reasoning of Salita Reynolds, who's a very smart director of the Los Angeles Department of Transportation, it will have the same sorts of effects that the building of infrastructure has had in the second half of the 20th century. It's just that it will be harder to see, right? Much harder to get a feel for how the new digital infrastructures are taking on roles once played by our concrete infrastructures. I'm going to end there. I hope I've introduced some questions. If we can maybe pick up on some of the crash stuff. I've resisted the temptation to be morbid, but I'm happy to be if people would like. But let me just end there and pass over to Jamie.
Great. Thank you, Jack. It's always exciting to follow up somebody who just absolutely knows your stuff better than you do. So thank you. let me follow a couple quick things. So first of all, we're supposed to not be talking about the trolley problem, which as with Jack, I'm very excited about this. But I do want to say that I don't think we should spend time talking about it anymore because at least in the United States, we've already answered the trolley problem. In the United States, for the most part, the federal government and even most of the state governments have taken a step back and said, corporations, whatever you want to do, you guys do it. There's a little bit of control at the federal level to try to coordinate between companies, but beyond that, it's very, very little. And we know what companies are going to do. Mercedes executive a few years ago perhaps made a little slip up, but basically said that the Mercedes vehicles with automated features will first and foremost save the occupants inside the vehicle. And to tell you the truth, that's probably what they should do. If I was to buy a car, I would want to know that it was there to protect me. Governments are the ones that promote the broader good, that say, no, we have to think about the broader good, the public good, rather than the individual good. And therefore, there is an opportunity for governments to make regulations that would actually protect 10 pedestrians over one driver. But thus far, at least in the United States, the government has chosen not to take that tact. So, Jack mentioned that I do a fair amount of work on the history of automated vehicles, and Nathan mentioned that perhaps these haven't just arrived a few weeks ago, as some people think. So I've done a bit of work looking at all the way back to the 1930s, although I've run across work that goes back even farther, and visions of automated vehicles. And I will cut and paste into the browser here the latest article I wrote on that, if you'd like to read the details. It's in a German history of technology journal, which the name I cannot pronounce, so I'm not even going to try here. but the thing that really comes out of that research that I find intriguing for this conversation is the number of different reasons over the last 100 years that have been touted for why automated vehicles should be built and why entire systems of automated transportation should be created. So the original ideas back in the 30s that I've looked at, it's not really about safety at all. It's actually about speed. The ability to move very quickly from the inner city into the beautiful outdoors and to link farms with the culture that you might get in a city. All of those things, if you can imagine the roads in the United States in the 1930s, they were not in the best shape. And it took quite a bit of time to get around. So automation was one of the things that would speed that process up. Over time, especially in the 1990s, when I rode my first automated vehicle, the huge push was this word called throughput. It was a bunch of federal highway engineers who knew the political impossibility of doubling the number of lanes on our interstate highways and our streets through our cities, and making the argument that if you automated things, you could squeeze a lot more vehicles into that given amount of space and therefore erase traffic jams. Safety really doesn't get talked about until the latest round. It's only in the last 10, 15 years that safety has been a priority for automated vehicles. And now you're getting a little bit, as Nathan mentioned as well, about access, about more people being able to be motive. I'll give you my personal take here. I'm a little concerned about the move to automated vehicles, but the one thing I'm pretty sure is just about when it becomes unsafe for me to drive is about when automated vehicles are going to happen. So the timing might work really well for me. I might get the best of both worlds. So that's a new thing. And the idea that it could be environmentally beneficial. I think the thing, though, is most technologies don't solve 5 to 6 major world problems all at once at the same time. almost always they saw some things better than others. As with the original gasoline-powered automobile, it did a really good job of allowing further travel. It allowed faster travel. It did not do a very good job on cleaning up the environment, and it didn't do a great job on safety. So I think we as citizens need to think about what are our goals? What are the values that we have? Right now, the conversation is largely being driven by a handful of corporations. And I think we really, as a group, need to think about what would we actually want out of this technology? And then how do we mobilize to make those voices heard? So the last thing I wanted to talk about, to come back to what Jack mentioned, is to talk about Elaine Hertzberg. The crash that she died in happened about 2 miles from my house. I actually drive by the crash site twice a day on my way to and from work. The story there is interesting to me because, first of all, it didn't have to happen. And let me give you a little bit of the political backstory of it. The reason why Uber was testing in Arizona is because the state of California announced that they would like some basic regulations of automated vehicles. They wanted to know which vehicles were being automated, and they wanted some basic statistics about the safety records of those vehicles. Uber decided in the middle of the night that they would refuse this demand. And the governor of Arizona announced about the same time, hey, automated vehicle companies, forget those silly regulations. Come to Arizona, do all the testing you want. Don't worry about a thing. That was the official stance. The implicit stance for me studying the histories of these was, please use the citizens of Arizona as your guinea pigs in this experiment. Kill as many of them as you want. We're not going to worry about it. After Elaine was killed, Governor Ducey announced, no, he did not mean make my citizens guinea pigs, and he banned Uber from testing for a period of time. But what it really came down to for me is two of my favorite engineering ethics scholars are named Martin and Schinzinger, and they did some great textbooks over the years in engineering ethics, which were used across the United States and beyond, I believe. And I think their fundamental best contribution to the discussion was this idea that engineering is a social experiment, that no technology is ever finalized in the lab. The final details are always shaken out after the technology is used with human beings and we learn about what maybe works and what doesn't work, and hopefully we adjust as a result. But ultimately, with any new technology, the initial users especially are the guinea pigs that it's being tested on. And their plea is that individual citizens should have some say in this, that they, like drug trials, should have some sort of informed consent. They should have an understanding of what the technology involves and what is involved. And then they should be able to decide whether or not they want that technology tested on them. Many, many people volunteer for drug trials for a variety of reasons. One of the reasons is for the greater good. They recognize they may be putting themselves at some risk, but the overall long-term benefit will be great, and they are happy to help the advance of technology that way. In Arizona, the citizens of Arizona were not asked whether or not they wanted to be guinea pigs in this test. On a daily basis, I walk with my daughter down streets that do not have street lights, that do not have sidewalks, with automated vehicles driving past me. It's not a situation I'm really, really comfortable with. There are some companies that appear to be doing a very good job and taking pedestrians very much into account. But if you'll read Jack's book, you will very clearly see that the Uber was not one of those companies. In fact, had gone so far as to disable most of the fail-safe devices on it because they were giving too many false positives. And to speed the process of engineering, they turned them off. And because the vehicle that killed Elaine had the systems that would have prevented it probably from killing her, but they had turned them off. And whether or not the woman behind the wheel at the time knew that is another question as well. And actually, Jack, you may know the answer to that. But so just to quickly sum up, I think two things is I would love to have a broader conversation about the values implicit in automated vehicles, what we as citizens would like to see from the technology. And I think that Jack's sort of detailed analysis showing us just what the stakes are involved is a hugely important component to us having that broader conversation.
Great. Thank you both for that really provocative introduction to these topics. What we're planning on doing now, if we can get everything to work properly, is to turn it over to the larger group to ask questions, to respond. Jack and Jamie, you're welcome to kind of have a dialogue across your two conversations. We do have the Dig Ethic address is the host of the conference and is going to be helping me figure out who's asking questions. There is a raise your hand button at the very bottom of your Zoom screen. You can also use the chat to raise questions or to get our attention. You may have noticed that as our speakers have been talking, I've been posting links to some of the things that they've mentioned, Peter Norton's book, Jack's book, Jameson's. Yes, that is the longest German phrase I've ever seen. And the Martin and Schitzinger book, which is an excellent, really excellent resource. And I will continue to do that as part of the larger product that comes out of these series. We will be developing a website, we'll be posting all the recordings, but also including reading lists, works cited, resources for people who want to be able to engage a little more deeply than what they've gotten here. Nate, I'm assuming you're on the line with me. If you can help me figure out how best to answer questions. It looks like actually we just have a small crowd here, so I'm going to start with a question that I have a long list, so I can keep us engaged forever. The first list maybe is most targeted towards Jamie, although I think Jack, you may want to identify this. And it's an argument that's made about new technologies, particularly new technologies that fail, which is, this is just growing pains. We'll work out the details eventually. Yes, the Uber vehicle killed a pedestrian, but it's getting better all the time, right? So it very much puts both the ethical responsibility, but also the agency in the hands of engineers or manufacturers. And I was wondering maybe what your reflections on the kind of growing pains or infant industry argument might be.
Great. Thanks, Nathan. So I certainly agree that there are always growing pains with new technologies. And I think the question is, what is the right steps to take to mitigate those pains as much as possible? Mm-hmm. And let me just give a couple of quick examples. So, I mean, actually, one of the best examples is the federal drug policy in the United States. You can't just take a new drug, throw it on the market, and hope it works. You go through a series of tests. You go through a series of incredibly cumbersome tests, right? There do come times, however, when it is judged that actually speeding up the innovation is worth it. And we're cursed under a situation like that right now, where finding a vaccine for COVID-19 is at the forefront of lots and lots of people's minds around the world. And as a result, they are finding ways to expedite the process and to be able to move those trials much more quickly. Now, inevitably, as we move those trials more quickly, it is more dangerous, and there are likely to be more negative effects. But we as a society and the FDA has decided, and I think it's the right decision, the greater good that can come, even if we get a vaccine a week earlier, literally could save thousands of lives. And so we're making that trade-off. Now, with automated vehicles, this is what happens on a regular basis, is the argument that it is necessary to deploy it as fast as possible because drivers behind the wheel kill so many people on a daily basis. And I think if we had really, really good statistics that could absolutely, unequivocally prove that that is the case, that an automated vehicle that we have now would save more lives than drivers behind the wheel, then you'd have a really strong argument for testing on people with very limited regulations. And Jack, you know these statistics better than I do. I think the latest statistics say that per mile, automated vehicles kill more people than normal drivers, or am I off on that?
I don't know, because it all depends on what you call an automated vehicle. Right, so
yeah,
you know, Tesla got into trouble recently because it made a similar claim that yes, driving on autopilot, which is not, you know, full automation, that's just, you know, an advanced form of, in effect, cruise control that Tesla likes to sell as a self-driving technology in order to get people to pay more for its cars. So Tesla got into trouble by for saying that it was safer, and an amateur statistician just took their figures to pieces. So the other thing I would add, Jamie, I think you're absolutely right in terms of, you know, the experimentality of new technologies, right? Which we would be kidding ourselves if we thought that you could just decide upon the safety of a technology and then deploy it, right? And we know that there is no clear line between experimentation and deployment. As you said, the social experiment, you know, is a spectrum rather than a clear, this is the laboratory and this is the real world. Given that though, so if we accept that reality, the question and the political question for me becomes one of, yeah, okay, we're learning by doing. So the question is, who's learning what, right? Why, rather than just the developer of the technology learning something and deciding what the relevant question is, why not do what some regulators have done? I mean, you mentioned in California a very modest attempt to try to democratize that learning a little bit. Just to say, tell us what works and what doesn't, right? So California asked companies to do what they call disengagement reports. Tell us how often you have to intervene in your test system and publish those things, right? So that we can all find out, we can slightly democratize the progress and direction of the technology. It's a very modest intervention, but is greeted by some as you know, communism in action. The other thing I would say is, whenever there is such a strong justification for the rapid development of a technology, we have to force back into the debate some consideration of what the alternatives to that technology might be. So if you want to have a discussion about safety, great, let's have a discussion about safety. Let's have a discussion about all the things that lead to the death rate in the US being about 3 times per mile what it is in Britain and Sweden, right? That's not because one country is more technologically advanced than the other, right? It's because of a set of political choices about how you trade off freedom and safety, how you enforce your traffic laws, whether or not you mandate technologies that add the, you know, relatively cheap but easy improvements in safety. And it's those sorts of things. So yes, we can have a rounded conversation about safety as soon as we presume that there is a technological fix for it. You know, a vaccine is neat in that it is a genuine technological fix for an infection. The fit in the case of self-driving cars is far less neat.
Yeah. It's interesting that I think that all three of us alluded to the idea that this is a longer story than is typically portrayed. And at least in my mind, the narrative that's emerged around autonomous vehicles, which then becomes a larger narrative about rapid progress in artificial intelligence, is critically dependent on a time frame that begins in 2004 with the first DARPA Grand Challenge. And some of our audience may have seen these videos of that Grand Challenge. They're hilarious. There are all kinds of cars that crash and run over things. It's kind of like a Three Stooges slapstick. And I believe that none of the vehicles makes it through the entire test course, which is itself a carefully controlled environment. But then by 2014, just a decade later, we have Google introducing into an actual roadway its very first prototype. And in a lot of the narratives about AI, the future of work and society, this it, look what we did in 10 years, imagine what the next 10 years will be. And so I guess I'm asking you to reflect a little bit on why it matters that this is a story that doesn't begin in 2004. Like, what does that tell us about either the technology, about infrastructure, about policy? And maybe I don't want to lead the question here. I think it matters, but I'm an historian. I always think that. But maybe the two of you could, you both alluded to this longer history. So could you say a little bit more about why that matters to our understanding?
Maybe I could go first, and Jamie, you could, because you're the proper historian, you could fill this in. And it's something that I took from an early piece that Jamie wrote about the, you know, as soon as we recognize that there are not just longer histories, but multiple histories, right? So we can start to see that the technology does not have one inevitable future. Mm. It is not an inevitable future in which AI develops to the point at which it has superhuman intelligence and therefore is able to take over all of the human tasks of driving, right? It is, so that's a narrative that is based around the autonomy of the vehicle. One of the things that I took from reading the few histories that there are of self-driving technologies was that early visions were actually visions of self-driving systems, right? Self-driving highways, self-driving infrastructures. Mm-hmm. And one of the fascinating things, talking to developers now, because one of the things that I do a lot of now is interviews with developers, is especially in the US, they have given up on infrastructure, right? There is the recognition that for reasons of investment, you know, private equity does not deal with more than 10-year time span, but also the political situation. You know, infrastructure, they pretty much regard as static. Therefore, if improvements to the system must only come through improving the smartness of the car rather than the smartness of the road. Now, in other countries, China, Singapore, right, they have a much stronger infrastructure-led vision, which means that the technology will take on very different shapes in different places. Jamie, you could probably correct me and fill in the gaps for that.
No, this is awesome. You just summarized a lot of my work. I can just talk about other stuff. So everything that Jack just said, and let me just build on one of the implications of that. Let's turn to values. We'll move from the design individual cars versus a system that integrates everything together. One of the things you lose when you go to the current format in the United States, which is a bunch of individual cars, is everything on the road is going to compete against each other. When you have a system designed as a whole, where the cars and the vehicles and the infrastructure and the roads all talk to each other, that's cooperation. That is everything working together to achieve a common goal. And I think this is one of the major things. If you really are concerned about safety, if that's the reason to do this, then putting a bunch of companies with competitive cars against each other on the road is the last thing you should do. So if you're going to think about values, decide what you want. I'll stop there.
Okay. Thank you both. I'm just realizing now that the way the Zoom webinar format works is a little different from the way a Zoom meeting works. And I'm just now seeing some of the questions from our audience. Some of them are in chat or typed, and some of them are people raising their hands. So let me first start. Peter Schwartz, are you still online? Do you want to, we can unmute you and you can ask your question. Nate, can you help us unmute Peter? I see Peter on the screen now.
Yeah, he needs to unmute himself though. He now can, but he.
There you go. Okay. Did that work?
Yes, we can hear you now.
like an autonomously driving car with this worked without killing our connection or something. Yeah, hi, I'm Peter Schwartz. I'm the director of the IU Center for Bioethics. And I was interested in your description of sort of the testing that's required in medicine before, for example, medicine is put into play, unless there's some kind of enormously pressing public health situation or health situation, such as with AIDS or COVID. But you know, AI is being implemented throughout medicine without that kind of testing. You know, I mean, it's very interesting to think about this. What is a car? Is a car an AI innovation, as it's been described in this in the seminar, or is it a a pill? Other places in medicine where the disanalogy of extensive testing holds is also in surgery, where new surgical procedures are generally not tested. Again, I'm with you. I'm love what you've said about the hype and the attempt to brush under the rug dangers, potential problems. But I was interested in these analogies to medicine and your thoughts on that.
Can we go to Jack?
Let me just, Jamie, because you brought this up first time around, and I was actually involved in a debate about, you know, what might a sort of clinical trial system look like for AVs, and for the, it was quite clear that for the AI people involved in that discussion and for the car people involved in that discussion, it looked like such an onerous system that it couldn't even be countenanced, right? The idea of that many checks on software before the deployment of a technology, because the regulatory reality is that software can be deployed in almost any setting with very, very light touch regulation. And I think, Peter, your question about AI and medicine is absolutely right, right? If we were to regard AI as a therapeutic treatment in the way that we regard, you know, a monoclonal antibody or a gene therapy, right? We would take it very, very seriously if we think, okay, if it's going to have the benefits that you suggest, then let's test those benefits and work out the safety and design a system that allowed us to do that in a responsible way. And it's extraordinary that when a novel technology comes along, those rules are not felt to apply to that novel technology. Instead, it's we will start with a blank slate and we will design the regulations to suit them. You know, I don't subscribe to this view that new technologies always create a gap with regulation, right? It's just often that we choose not to apply the regulations that we have to the technologies that come along because, I don't know, we hope that this time it's going to be different. I don't know. What are your thoughts, Jamie?
So I'm not an expert in the FDA. Probably, Peter, you know more about this than I do, but let me put this whole conversation in a little bit of a context. In these realms, there's sort of generally two ways of thinking about regulation, or it's often put into two realms, right? We have the precautionary principle approach, where you have to prove that it's safe before you deploy it. And then we have the American approach, which is deploy it until it kills enough people that the media starts to notice or lawyers start to notice, and then we'll think about regulation. Major place within the United States where the precautionary principle is really taking focus is in the FDA and in our drug regulations. Now, it is so hard in the US to use the precautionary principle in any regulatory realm that even the FDA can't do it in all things. So what the FDA can approach with clinical trials is very, very specifically mandated and a narrow thing. And easily lots and lots of things happen in medicine that don't fall underneath that category. And so that's why, you know, AI simply falls out of the realm. Let me just give you one other quick example of this. You know, as a social scientist researcher, I have to apply for human subjects permission in order to do the kind of research that I do. I once had a conversation with a group of graduate students in social sciences and engineering. And when the social scientists realized that the engineers could do anything they wanted to the general public without any permission or any review, they were outraged. But that really is the way we have set things up in this country, is that engineering, by and large, is not treated as a social experiment. And therefore, getting consent or having a discussion about the ethics of rolling things out is often not done.
Thank you. Thank you both. This is really interesting, this question about also novelty or newness freeing you from regulation. I write about the computer industry, which has successfully argued for about the last 50 years that they are a new industry and therefore cannot be regulated without crushing it. And it's interesting to see firms define themselves as tech firms, I think, because of that. So you think about the case of Theranos, for example, which is really a biomedical company that by defining itself as a tech firm is able to circumvent the oversight that might normally have come. Now, I'm realizing that there are a couple mechanisms for asking questions. So Jack and Jamie, you'll see a little button that says Q&A, and there are a couple written questions, but there's also one in chat, which is very interesting. And so I'm gonna just read that. This is from Joshua, or I'll paraphrase. The question is really about whether, how do we take into account the form of implication of implementation of these vehicles, and the thrust here is, you know, kind of how do we balance communal goods like self-driving cars, mobile medical testing vehicles, all the good things that might come, versus the expected tens of thousands, possibly more, of truck drivers, other professional drivers who might be put out of work who won't see the benefit. So there's this wonderful sentence at the end: how much is the shown video of the vehicles pushing people off the road stand as a kind of metaphor? And what part does design take in the ownership of outcomes behind the tech of the device at hand? And I'm thinking here of Karen Levy's work on truck drivers being displaced by autonomous vehicles. So this is the kind of broader question maybe about technologically driven unemployment that comes with this as well.
Yeah, I mean, my own sense is that like the debate, like the trolley problem, right? A lot of the debate about employment and AI is overhyped itself. It's just overhyped in a different direction, right? So it's dystopian rather than utopian. And I think once we engage with the uncertainties of the technology, we can see that they are likely to have much more complicated systems for their transition and systems for their development, which means that, for example, we're likely to see forms of human and machine cooperation that currently don't really fit the idea of just replacing humans with machines. So we're likely to see forms of cooperation before we see the wholesale firing of truck drivers. Which is not to downplay those concerns, right? Mm-hmm. It may well be that what that means is the quality of work is impacted before the quantity of work. So, you know, I would worry about, and this, you know, follows Karen Levy's argument, I would worry about truck drivers being, for example, more closely surveilled while they go about their job. Or, for example, where an automated system takes over for large parts of their highway driving, and maybe the argument goes, well, you're not at work then, so we're not going to pay you for those bits, even though you're stuck in the cab of your truck. So, you know, we can learn from the experience of places like Amazon to see how that might play out. It's just going to play out in more complicated ways than if you were to ask a computer scientist whose job is coming next, they might imagine.
Yeah, just real quick. So, I mean, the vast majority of technologies are designed implicitly to put people out of work. So I don't think these are going to be any different. But I really like Jack's nuance here, is that it's going to change relationships before it immediately fires people. So it may mean that you can hire a 22-year-old off the street to drive a truck cross country, whereas before you probably would have had some sort of system where you get them some experience before you did that. And of course, that means you can fire the 45-year-old person who makes a lot of money and hire a 22-year-old person at a very low rate. So that's the kind of thing that will likely happen. But let's look beyond truck drivers. This technology, the arguments being made, it changes what it means to be a parent. The idea that you no longer have to take your child to soccer practice, right? And what are the social ramifications of that? Driving your kids and, you know, being the uh, being the bus for your children as you take them from event to event is quite a burden. At the same time, for some parents, it's the only time they spend with their children.
Right.
So once you take that away from them, what does the relationship between parents and their kids look like? And those are some of the really big, broader things that we can speculate about and make some predictions about, but it's going to be a slow evolution that we're going to very gradually realize, oh yeah, I don't talk to my child anymore.
That is interesting. Now, Jack and Jamie, can you now see the questions that are coming from the audience in the Q&A box?
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
Would you want to kind of take those? We can take them top to bottom, or is that all right? Would you like me to read them out?
Let me take on, Daniel's one. So Daniel is one of my MSc students, so that's totally cheating. Oh. but thank you for the question, Daniel. So this is about, you know, what might people like us do to actually not just study and interpret and analyze the debate, but try to inform the debate in some way. And I think this is, you know, it's what I would say. I mean, I try to be optimistic about this. I try to say, as a researcher, the reason I'm in this business is that I hope to contribute to making the world a better place rather than just studying it's falling apart. But, you know, the tricky thing with the conversations that I've had with, whether they're small, say, tech startups or big, so OEMs, car makers, say traditional car makers, is that they all of those organizations come with their own set of commitments. And it's very hard to get past those own set of commitments. So we talked, for example, about how tech startups are stuck in the 5-year time horizon with which they have to justify their own existence.
Mm.
Which means that it creates the incentive to hype. It creates the incentive to emphasize autonomy rather than collaboration, right? To emphasize disruption, which makes it very hard to intervene in those debates. Now, I do think, you know, most of those startups still, you know, they do at least express the desire to do the responsible thing. It was interesting in the wake of the Uber crash, for example, seeing how that company, you know, privately has learnt from that disaster and recognized that that wasn't just technological failure, but it was also a failure of its corporate culture. And how the other companies, again, you know, they haven't come out and said as much, but how they have been taken aback by that crash, that death, and that has changed how they think about the relationship to these questions. You know, sometimes it does take a crisis. That's the difficult thing if you are, you know, a social scientist that's trying to understand and inform these debates.
Yeah, thanks for that, Jack. One technique that I have found can be useful is if you talk about history rather than the present. So I once had the opportunity to sit down with the vice president of Ford for safety, and she was more than happy to talk about the deaths that resulted from airbags, because they were in the middle of a little controversy that's now known as the Ford Firestone controversy, where some of their SUVs were falling over as a result of the company asking people to radically change the way they fill the air in their tires. So for a really big company, if you focus on the here and now, you might struggle. But if you focus on the past and think about how that might play out in the present, that might be your in to do that.
Do either of you want to take on the question from George? This is a question dear to my heart. I've written a fair bit about chess and its relationship to artificial intelligence. And the question is about whether we need if there were a kind of Kasparov beats Deep Blue moment for autonomous vehicles to kind of shift public perception, kind of what would that be? What would that look like? Do we need one? Is such a thing possible? Has it already happened?
So I've been telling a lot of people that driving is not chess, right? And I mean, Nathan, you've written and talked about how, you know, if chess was the test case for artificial intelligence of one generation, self-driving cars become the test case for another generation of artificial intelligence. you know, like the model organism for those things. And the odd thing with self-driving cars is that it's such a terrible, terrible test case because you're engaging in such a complicated world. Maybe I will just be surprised by some breakthrough in machine learning, but, you know, at the moment I would bet on the fact that for self-driving cars to work, and maybe this speaks to Eric's question as well about the maturity of the technology, you know, it will work not by mimicking and then superseding human performance. It will work by people from different parts of life coming together to assemble workable systems, right? So artificial intelligence, just left to its own devices, will not do the job on its own. And the building of those systems is going to become a complicated, collaborative thing. So this is the sort of thing that might get me into trouble, but I would say there will be no deep blue movement for self-driving cars.
Jamie, do you want to try that one?
Yeah, so 23 years ago in August, I was on a Buick LeSabre being driven autonomously down I-15. Is it I-15 or I-5? I can't remember. I think it was I-15. In San Diego, and it performed flawlessly for 12 miles in a situation very much similar to a chess tournament. You know, the roads were blocked off. There was no other traffic allowed. There was, you know, constant surveillance to ensure that for some reason a random deer didn't wander onto the highway. Everything, the rules were known. The rules were created, and the automated vehicles worked perfectly when all the rules were clearly stated and the vehicles knew the rules. That's not what automated driving is in our world. It could be. We could imagine setting up interstate highways such that it would be chess-like. But right now, the goal is to ask automated vehicles to perform all driving tasks, not simply very controlled interstate driving tasks.
Yeah, that's so interesting, Jamie. And I think, therefore, the thing to watch for is the moment when the people who, say, control infrastructure or control the movements of pedestrians say, well, what would it take to make driving more like chess? Right, which you can do. I mean, you know, we've had driverless trains in London for decades now, and it's a closed system. It's like a game of chess. They work really well.
Jack, to me, that's terrifying. to have another round of Peter Norton's work showing the ways that we make sure we eliminate people from all forms of walking because we have to make the roads safe for automated vehicles. So all bicycles, all pedestrians are not allowed to walk outside of their house because it's too unsafe.
You know, in some ways that turns us back to a point that you made early on, Jack, which is that or an argument you made, which is that maybe the key questions aren't ethical, they're political. So including the questions about the displacement of certain kinds of workers or changes in work, if we think about autonomous vehicles as being part of systems, you know, that we have to redesign the city or the built environment at the same time we're redesigning the technologies, it becomes a matter of investment. Are we willing to do this? And who benefits and who pays? So maybe this brings me to a kind of final question. I'm very aware that Zoom exhaustion is a real thing, and we kind of promised an hour, but you know, the kind of closing question I'm thinking I'm going to pose to all of our speakers is really for the larger project and for the Lilly Foundation, which is kind of what's next? You know, what would we need in order to have some better dialogue, regulation, conversation, whatever it might be about these particular issues? And, you know, Jack, you're suggesting we need a political process that incorporates, that can take on these, but maybe that's too big of a question to end with, but let me rephrase it and see if you have an answer, which is kind of, if we want to do this better, where better means more participants in a thoughtful dialogue about what the future of autonomous vehicles look like. What do you think we need most or most immediately to make that happen?
I mean, so what, one easy answer is a thing that we've already started doing on behalf of the British government, which is broadening the conversation in sort of some quite strange ways. So we've been running a program of public dialogue for the British government's automated vehicles unit. And if nothing else, that surfaces the range of relevant questions. And it helps remind policymakers that members of the public are not Luddites. And often, you know, we set these things up as a battle between innovators, disruptors, and the people whose lives or whose livelihoods or industries would be disrupted. And I think in doing that, we lose the possibility for genuinely constructive debate about the possibilities of this technology. Because what you get if you go out and ask, you know, ordinary people about self-driving cars, well, in Britain at least, a strong sense of enormous possibility, coupled with a concern that the real benefits aren't going to be realized because the technology will, I don't know, you know, serve the interests of rich and powerful people or reflect what other, you know, political concerns they might have. So, you know, I think there is the space to have a genuinely constructive conversation here. It's not people that are pro or anti the technology. It's about genuinely how do we make the most of this technology for all of us, rather than just assuming that the direction that we're being told at the moment is the only possible direction.
So I might give a little more controversial answer. I'm not sure. I think there needs to be an awakening amongst the public of the ways in which their lives are shaped by technology. And I think to some extent that's already understood, but I don't think there's an understanding that something could be done about it. I get the sense with a lot of people in the United States that technology is something that happens to them. It's not something that they engage with or think about. There's not a thought that there's really something you could do about it. And one of the ways this has played out in Arizona is, you know, living in a testbed for automated vehicles, there's almost no response by the public about the presence of these vehicles wandering around all over the place. Even when Alain Hertzberg was killed, there's no uprising, there was no protest, there was no request that Uber stopped testing. A year or so ago, I heard rumors that somebody in Mesa, Arizona, which is not too far from my house, started throwing rocks at an automated vehicle. And I got so excited. I'm like, finally, somebody is standing up and taking a stand. Now, I don't condone throwing rocks at vehicles because there's people, actual human beings inside them. But it actually meant that somebody cared to stand up and say, hey, let's talk about this. So I think that there actually has to be a shift in the public understanding of technology and a belief that something can change. Otherwise, I think, you know, if you don't think you can make a difference in technology, why would you even go to one of Jack's public discussions? Hmm.
Yeah. Thank you. That was actually really, really helpful. I know I promised that would be the last question, but I'm realizing there's an attendee who's been waiting patiently, and I just did not see the little hand. Joel, are you still around? Do you want to ask your question? And Nate, can you unmute Joel?
Yeah, I just wanted to go back and make sure I understood what you were saying when you say that that the decisions we have to make are political decisions rather than ethical ones. On a certain level, I understand that on a policy level, but aren't there different levels here? Like, for example, if you were talking to a corporation, be it a Tesla or anyone else, is it enough for them to just comply with the law? Or do they have independent obligations to behave in a way that they find to be ethical and or consistent with their corporate culture? So for example, if a Google, and Google's a bad example in ethics, but if we were to just use Google as an example, if they were to decide that whatever the law ultimately is in Arizona or elsewhere, that they feel a personal sense or a corporate sense of greater obligation. So is every decision here a policy decision, or is a policy decision just to set the minimum standard with a corporation then having, or any other player in the system, then having an ethical obligation? And if so, how does that impact the decision-making process?
So let me just try and clarify. Thanks, Joel. Yeah, it's difficult because one can talk about politics in ethical terms. So questions of, say, fairness and justice, you could phrase ethically or politically, depending on your view. I guess when I'm critiquing ethics, I'm critiquing the particular ethics focus that has emerged around AI that, for example, privileges individual rights, emphasizes questions of, say, privacy, rather than questions of distributional justice, solidarity, those sorts of questions. But they're all values questions. And when I talk about politics, I'm not just talking about what politicians do, right? So one of the things that sociologists and historians of technology would emphasize is that scientists and engineers are making political decisions all the time, right? They're making decisions implicitly or explicitly that privilege some groups over others. I would want and seek to encourage responsible actors, including developers, to think about their own responsibilities in that regard, their responsibilities above and beyond just complying with the law of the land, while also focusing on, how the laws need to change in order to ensure some collective version of the good life. I hope that clarifies my position a little bit. I'm conscious that I don't want to open up a gigantic can of worms right at the end.
Well, actually, this is a nice foreshadowing. So that was a great question. But Joel is also a faculty member here at IU in the Kelly School of Business, as well as the convener of the topic area within this larger Lilly Endowment project on business ethics. So we may not have been able to entirely address this question here, but we will have a whole series of events that Joel will be running that I think will engage even more with this question of corporate responsibility versus individual responsibility as well. I do want to thank it. We're over time, but this has been such a productive conversation. This is always the worst part of any Zoom meeting because you can't clap. But I want to thank all of our attendees for joining us and remind them that we will be making both the recordings available, but also a list of the resources that we've referenced and some other follow-up materials if you're interested. But I particularly wanted to thank Jack and Jamie. We pulled this together on short notice, and I think this was just a wonderful kickoff to the kinds of conversations we're going to have. So thank you, everyone. Jamie and Jack, if I could ask you to remain on the line a little bit. I'm going to close off the recording, and we will be done for today. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.